We went into level 4 lockdown on the midnight of the 17th of August, which was...
Wednesday.
Oh, my mouse is freaking out. Wednesday, Tuesday, something like that. It's been a little rough. Supermarkets are out of toilet paper again. And now everyone is stuck at home in New Zealand. And it will probably go on for... Who knows at this point? We might go into level 3. I think at the moment we're looking to review it on Monday or something like that.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. Monday we're supposed to get an announcement.
Yeah. Yeah. So how have you been working during these tough, turbulent times, my friend?
So obviously with anything relating to coronavirus, is not positive. But if we look towards kind of the silver lining, I think it's given a lot of opportunity to just take a breather from work. Personally, I know I have been a little bit overworked recently, not due to the company, just myself. I'm going to drive some objectives and working long hours in the office. So it was a breath of fresh air. That is the silver lining. But hopefully this Delta variant won't spread too much and we won't have too much of a big impact. I think we made the right call in lockdown pretty early, and I think we were pretty fortunate enough early on in the cycle to go into the lockdown. So hopefully we won't see the peak jump too high. So there is some good news in that. But other than that, yeah, I think it's given me the chance to just catch a breather from work.
Cool. So a bit of positive in the, I suppose everyone else would say is very negative. Yeah, myself, I really enjoy lockdowns. I guess you could say I'm a bit of a masochist. I like spending a lot of time in very closed spaces with poor substandard lighting and no natural sunlight. So all good for me. I'm probably the healthiest that I've ever been other than being overweight. So that's great. So moving on, we'll talk about today the effects of activities in general, whether that be gaming and work or COVID lockdown or anything that's kind of deviant from normal behavior, quote unquote, and the effects on our emotions and vice versa. Our emotions affect on day-to-day activities and gaming and work and stuff like that. So I guess to start off with, I don't know so much about your history in ranked play in League of Legends or anything like that, Will, or Counter-Strike or anything. It's quite prevalent, especially in the League community, to see someone just completely lose their shit and just do completely bizarre and weird activities because they don't agree with something that you've done or think that they're going to lose or something and just go full tilt and throw their hands up in the air and say fuck you to everyone else.
Yeah, in some areas I guess that is a form of stress relief, but I think tilt is a huge underappreciated area, and if you are looking to succeed, it is definitely a portion that you should consider investing time in looking into, studying, and improving on, because you'll notice that there are a lot of players in the world, especially in professional gaming, that take the emotional side of games, or tilt. They'll consider it as a genre on its own, which is very, very valid and very true, and study that. And there's a lot to be learned from your mental game aspect or from the gaming point of view, and that can be kind of extended towards your personal life and also work life as well. So it is a very underappreciated topic, in my opinion.
Do you think that the, I guess, magnitude or severity or whether someone is likely to tilt or not is dependent on maybe why they play the game in the first place or their values or what they think they're not getting out of the gameplay experience, maybe? Or do you think it's something else?
Yeah, definitely. I think I've never really thought about it in that way, but I think you raise a really good point there. I think how you view the game or what you want to get out of the game may also have a direct correlation on how much you tilt. I think, for example, if you just play the game recreationally for fun, and you don't really care if you win or lose too much and you're just there to have a good time, then I would imagine that subset of group of players would tilt much less than someone who is just trying to be as competitive as can be and climb the ladder in any kind of game format.
Makes sense. And do you think that there's any particular games or experiences that lend themselves to be more or less prone to tilt? Or, like, would you say that, in your experience with poker, do you think that someone playing poker professionally would suffer tilt to the same degree as a professional League of Legends player, for instance?
I would equate them to be similar, but I would say for poker specifically, in the game of poker, there is a monetary factor involved in your action. Well, when we're talking about real money poker and not play money poker. But in real money poker, it's even recreational players, so even players who would play for fun. It's very hard to find anyone on the face of the earth who would not have any kind of emotional binding towards losing money or making money. So I would say poker is a really good example where most, if not all, players playing poker with real money actually experience tilt to some varying degree. And tilt can go both ways. I think we've got an idea of tilt being negative, but there is also a aspect of emotional gain or mental gain where if you're winning a lot, for example, I don't know if it's the correct term. I believe there's a hot hand fallacy or a hot streak fallacy. Yep. Where if you win enough times in a row, then you feel like the odds of winning again is somehow higher, even though objectively speaking, it's not the case. So there is the opposite of that as well in the kind of positive direction. So I think poker exacerbates this issue and is really a good example of how important mental game is.
Definitely. I think poker is probably a very good example to use because, as you've said, it lends itself very well to being one-to-one with some form of monetary exchange in some leagues. Or what do you call it in poker?
That would be considered a cash game where each of your chips corresponds to a direct cash value, whereas if you're playing a tournament style, then you just have a buy-in and then your rank, depending on how it's basically last to finish is first. So you try and remain the longest, be the last man standing, so to speak, and collect all the chips.
Yeah, so obviously if you're playing for the cash game or whatever it is, that's going to have a pretty much direct tie-in to some form of monetary value, and you watch that value go up and down as you win or lose. So money being very important to pretty much everyone on the face of the earth is probably going to be one of the most determining factors in whether somebody gets upset or starts to snowball into a state of tilt or not.
Yeah, definitely agree. And as humans, it's really hard to... It's only natural for humans when we get really emotional, we start to make decisions that, given a clear state of mind or no kind of emotional bias, we wouldn't make. So it really skews our actions sometimes. And I guess the mental game component is about trying to keep that in check. No matter how emotional we get, we still make the right call or make the right decisions, and we don't let emotions kind of impair our judgment, so to speak.
And I guess that ties in as well with the function, I suppose, of tilt being kind of like a snowball effect where if you're not, I guess, critically reflecting on what state you're currently in, you're probably going to end up slipping further and further into a state where it's going to be further against your most optimal lines of plays, and you're going to be disrupted from being at your peak performance.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've identified the first step in any kind of mental game self-help book, which would be identifying tilt and accepting it and just being honest and critical about when you are in that game, in that mind state. But that's the first step, is identifying and understanding it, and also accepting that you are in that state. Because without that acceptance, you're never going to get past that.
So without, I guess, compromising anything too untoward, or maybe talking about something in a previous role or something like that, can you think of a work-related example of the premise of tilt?
Oh, that is a very interesting topic, I think.
So, to speak generally, I think it could be related to people who were disempowered in a particular job role, who were getting a lot of negative work stream related activity, perhaps. As an example, if you were like a some form of network engineer or security architect or something, and you wanted to deploy like some form of bulk change, but you weren't given a particular application or something like that, or maybe your machine is so locked down that you can't install Python or something like that, and you're not able to automate a bulk change, which thus means that you need to do it manually. Needing to do that 10 or 20 times, you'd probably start to slip into a different side of reality after a while, I imagine.
Yeah, I could also give the very simple example of in a contact center, or specifically kind of customer care environment, if you just came off a call where it was a very kind of emotional escalation, and maybe that was a difficult call for you, the caller who called in, maybe they were swearing at you, use words that they really shouldn't have, and really got to you emotionally, then I can definitely see if that customer care agent wasn't I guess, in tune with emotion, or didn't really have that strong of a mental game, if I call it that, then the subsequent calls after that, they may not perform as they normally would at the beginning of their shift, or even with a clear state of mind. So even very simple requests that come through on a normal day, they would act really, really happy, really positive, provide the best service that they can provide. I can imagine that person may provide suboptimal service, or kind of be snappy back towards the customer if it could really affect their work stream, just coming off of that. And that could be an example of tilt in the workplace. I can see that being a really good example of tilt, actually, and something that I've probably encountered before in my career, and I assume you might have to some degree as well.
I'd say that's definitely a better example than the one I gave, as it's more related to the sort of snowball effect of tilt, right, and kind of throwing you out of your optimal frame of mind and putting you into a degraded state or suboptimal sort of level where you can't best perform your job role.
It's going back to kind of gaming. It's very common in gaming, right, where you may be performing suboptimally, or maybe you're doing your best, but there is some person or keyboard warrior on your team that's flaming you for doing XYZ. And then, you know, you can have people who it doesn't really affect them. Some people just turn off their game chat, but some people it really gets to them, and that it changes how they play. But the funny thing is, I think in most cases, the keyboard warriors actually have a drastic negative effect on all their team members when they're trash talking. It's interesting because I just want to get into the mindset of a keyboard warrior and really kind of understand what they think will happen when they start typing like that and really putting their teammates under the bus. Are they expecting a better result than if they hadn't typed anything? Are they expecting a person to go, oh, I didn't realize how garbage I was, let me correct that now and suddenly become the best player in the world? Like, what is the expectation there? Why are they doing that?
I think personally that part of it is the keyboard warrior themselves being affected by like a satellite function of tilt themselves. So like, obviously they're not impressed by your performance, or they feel the need to communicate that or whatever, right? But I think that it's getting to them in such a way that they need to voice that, because they don't have the maturity necessarily to kind of deal with that themselves, so they need to present that to the wider audience.
Fair call. I think a lot of them are stuck in that first phase where they have not identified or accepted it as being tilt. I guess in a lot of cases that I've seen, they simply go on for a long time. And even looking at interviews with reformed kind of League of Legends players who used to be very toxic, they'll often state that looking back, they didn't realize the effect that their words had on other team members. So I guess they were kind of blind, and that's fair enough. I think it's very tough to be self-critical of yourselves in that situation. We could talk about the ways we kind of deal with tilt, because we each have different methods, and there is no right or wrong way to deal with tilt. It's all dependent on the situation and how you deal with stress, or I guess the expectations. But how do you personally deal with tilt, Bob? Or what are some examples that you have?
So gaming-wise, I'll do one of two methods. One will be, well, basically depending on how invested I am in actually winning versus losing, and if I think it can be salvaged, then I will probably just mute the player, and continue on. Or if I find that there's too much of a risk for me becoming tilted myself from it, I'll just mute the player and move on. If, however, there's potential to have fun by stirring up the person even more into a debilitating rage and having them inflict the most insufferable agony they possibly can on the world, I will absolutely dive in there and roll them up. Usually, I prefer to do the first, just because I feel like I'm a better person by doing that.
No, fair enough. From my work with mental game, this was a huge problem for me when I was playing poker. So I think my learnings from mental game and tilt specifically have actually reshaped the way I approach life in general and how I think things through. So it's reshaped my fundamental approach to life. In poker specifically, one of the coaches that I had, one of my close mates, surprisingly helped me by saying something. So I was in a spot where I was making, when I did enter a tilt phase, for example, in poker, I would have done the right move. But in poker, there is always a variance aspect. So in this case, for example, I win 90% of the time, but there is 1 out of 10 times where I lose. And I had, for example, 3 times in a row, I was just on the 1 out of 10 chance 3 times in a row. And for me, that triggered a tilt aspect because I felt like I wasn't in full control. I'd made the right moves, I'd done everything correctly, but I was getting, in my mind, punished at that time for that. So that led me to make more mistakes downstream. It made me to be much more aggressive in my play, take more risks, much more risks than I needed to take. And it really affected my decision-making skills. So my friend said something to me that was kind of eye-opening that I still remember to this day. It's just pause, take a deep breath, look at the hand you played there, that specific example. Now channel your emotions at the moment and ask yourself how you would feel in a week's time, in a month's time, in a year's time, in 3 years' time, in 5 years' time. And it made me feel or made me realize that, hey, actually, in a week's time, I would have played 10,000s of more hands. I would have been in this very similar spot at least 10 more times in a week's time, and I would have forgotten all about it. By a month's time, I would have completely forgotten about it. In a year's time, that would be completely off the radar. And it's such a tiny little speck compared to everything else that it didn't make sense for me to have all this negative energy and for it to impact the rest of my day. And it was really eye-opening for me to look at it in that way, just zoom out a little bit and just see what it looks like in a week's time, in a month's time, and so forth. And that really helped me kind of channel and kind of zone back down and really look at poker in a long-term sense. And, you know, statistically speaking, that's fine. And as long as I made the right move, the outcome doesn't matter because I am confident in my fundamentals. I'm confident in my analysis. And the end result, in the short term doesn't matter if I'm confident in my study there. So it helped me a lot understand. And that was one tiny aspect of it. But there's a lot of things like that where you can take it as a life example. If something bad happens to you, for example, if if someone at work throws you a negative comment. But if you really zoom out and you think, if that's kind of, if you feel like that's ruined your day, just ask yourself, how would you feel about that comment in a week's time, a month's time, a year's time, in 3 years' time? Does it really matter to you? And the answer is probably no. In a month's time, you would have forgotten about it. In a year's time, there is no way that's going to get to you. So if you zoom out and look at it in that sense, then you can kind of, I guess, handle that emotion a lot better, or it helped me personally anyway. So that was kind of the ways that, one of the ways that I dealt with tilt or the negative emotion.
It sounds like it comes down to emotional processing time and like working through your emotions, essentially. Not unlike a grieving process or like just being self-critical of what state you're in at the moment kind of thing, and just taking it back and being neutral and thinking, does this actually matter? Is this actually relevant? Like, am I okay, or am I distorting my interpretation of the events kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Something you said kind of makes me want to segue this a little bit, because what you're saying about like events that do last longer, sort of stuff that you think about, or maintaining emotional presence, I guess. So you know how when you start like a RuneScape account, for instance, and you look at all the cool shit that's in the late game that you want to do, and then you like plan out your account a little bit to go to do this, I need to do this quest and level this skill to whatever, and you build this sort of pathway that you want to take to train up your account before it gets to that point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So personally, I really love that kind of meta game where you sit there and you copy and paste links into the wiki until you get some answers, and then you structure it into lists and shit like that. But specifically, I wanted to talk about the implications of having a hardcore Iron Man account. Like, I'm not sure if you're aware or not, but basically a hardcore Iron Man is you have one life, and if you die, you are no longer a hardcore Iron Man. You become a regular Iron Man account.
Yep, so it's the ultimate hardcore mode of the game. You only have one life in an MMORPG.
Yeah, exactly. Well, a kind of MMORPG. Let's be honest, it's pretty much a single-player game. It's just got a couple of multiplayer elements. It's basically like Second Life top-down with like a little bit of health bars and whacking stuff to kill them and get fat loots. So a hardcore Iron Man really, if you actually give a shit about the game mode, which you should if you're planning for a late game Iron Man, it really adds a couple of extra layers of depth and experience to the game, including a whole part around the, basically like a grieving period, really, because you will die at some point. You will lose all that progress, and you need to be, well, it doesn't matter if you are prepared or not. It will happen. The only way to avoid it, obviously, is to not play. It gets to the point eventually, you get to a certain stage where you pretty much unanimously among late game hardcore Iron Men, you have nightmares about losing your status. Like, you will wake up in the middle of the night and you will think that your account has died. It gets that bad. It's rough. I would never make another one, I don't think. It's not worth it. But to get that experience firsthand was absolutely worth it. The point where I did die, and thinking back on it and like really, really being critical of everything I could have done to avoid that death, I think that relates quite a bit from the opposite side of what you've just mentioned, of instead of like thinking about how you're going to feel in like a month, a week, a day, to instead have it flipped on you and been like, so I've just lost everything. And then that moment of realization and going, oh shit, and like playing back in your head what you could have done to avoid it. Like, it's not the same as tilt, obviously. It's more of like a reaction based on grieving from an emotional investment into the game. But I don't imagine it would be very distant from that to winning a all-in hand in cash poker.
Yeah, you raise a really interesting point there. I think there is for hardcore, and I'm just guessing here. So when you're playing the hardcore mode, obviously activities such as going into a PvP area where you can die, such as the wilderness, if you're playing on your main account, for example, even if you did have valuable assets that you'd lose on death in there, I would imagine that going into the wilderness on your hardcore is very stressful, and the emotional aspects of having an Iron Man might actually cloud your judgment on some of your actions there. So I think that actually is a really good prime example of tilt, but I think you're right. The example that you gave of hardcore of losing your hardcore Iron Man is a little bit different. I think it's a long-term kind of tilt factor that you mentioned there, something that actually impairs or has an emotional toll on you for longer periods of time. I think the same kind of methods in de-stressing or working on your mental game would definitely help in that scenario as well, but it's two very different examples.
Oh, yeah, it's completely different. Where I was more going with this was more the, I guess, the loss or the emotional investment, and very closely linked to losing like a hand in a cash game of poker, right? Like, you physically lost money. Money's pretty damn important, if not the most important thing to pretty much everyone. So seeing that go is going to have a toll on a person. It's kind of interesting what you said, actually, about how, yes, you do obviously, as a hardcore Iron Man, process events differently and choose to, in general, if you're going for a late-game hardcore Iron Man, you choose to alleviate high-risk activities in favor of doing stuff that's a lot safer but lower reward. Specifically in the example for wilderness and high risk PvP activities, the mentality is if you're going to do it, you should do it hard. I actually think that you would find that a hardcore Iron Man in the wilderness is going to be kitted out in all his best in slot gear and is probably going to put up one hell of a fight.
Yeah, I would definitely agree there. But if you look at kind of two scenarios, for example, where you look at a player who in his mind doesn't want to die in any situation in RuneScape but isn't a hardcore, and you put him into a hardcore setting and you both play out their kind of account growth, I would say that if they did enter the wilderness, the person on the hardcore account would be a lot more alert. Tilt would be much more of a factor there. And when I say tilt, I mean just that emotional thought of dying, that fear of dying, would probably be suboptimal in some sense as compared to if you played on a non-hardcore, still with the mindset of I kind of don't want to die, so if someone does attack me, I'll still put up a fight. You might find that for, I guess, non-skilled players not at the kind of high echelon, they'll react a lot more differently. If they're on their hardcore, they might panic a lot more, whereas on their main, they might panic less. So that's just an assumption at this stage, but I can see that being kind of a thing, because I know I definitely panicked, even not playing hardcore, but just in wilderness. But there is an emotional factor of entering into the wilderness in RuneScape.
Absolutely. It's for normal players, it is probably the most high adrenaline activity in the game. And for that reason, I kind of don't want them to touch it, but they probably will. Because there is nothing more exciting than taking a trip into the wilderness to do your shitty clue scroll that you're going to get like 100k loot from. And then the potential risk of dying and losing like a couple of mil if you're well kitted out or whatever. But yeah, you're right. It's not like a one-to-one thing. It's definitely a different type of example for a different type of reaction or emotional reaction from it. As a hardcore, you do tend to get a little bit more stressed on certain activities that normal players probably wouldn't. Probably more so because in general with a hardcore you're trying to knock out a lot of riskier content early on when your account isn't really as trained as a normal account would be. So you see a lot more scarier things happen.
What's kind of funny is I would kind of provide a similar analogy in poker. So all things equal, for example, let's say your bankroll in poker, so the amount of money that you have in poker is $1,000. If it was $1,000, you'd generally be playing something like a $10 cash game or a $20 cash game where your bankroll sufficiently supports large amounts of variance. So at any point, it is rare to lose your entire stack, but if you did, it'd be $10 and your bankroll is $1,000. So it goes up and down. But throw that person into a $1,000 game where their whole entire bankroll is on the line and can be lost in one single hand. Even if they're playing the exact same opponents who, you know, you assume your opponent's strategies don't differ here and it's exactly the same. You'll notice things exactly like you said, where players stop playing the most optimal route because they start reducing their risk. So even if there is, you know, if the optimal route does have some kind of implied risk, but it's winning a lot of money in the long run, people won't take that. They'll take the lower risk and at sometimes suboptimal losing play of just being very defensive. And I think that's kind of similar to playing on a hardcore compared to a normal. You'll just forego a lot of optimal lines because there is an inherent risk. If you're playing on your main account, even with that risk, it would be so negligible in a lot of cases. For example, you might not even want to go to dragons, even though you have a dragon anti-dragon shield and you have enough food. You just in your mind, it's a mental block, and you go, nope, no dragons for me, never. You know, something like that. It would be so suboptimal. You're just wasting so much time going around. But I can see that adding up.
Yeah. Because in the end, for a hardcore, like, the only thing that matters is whether you're still a hardcore or not. So any growth on the account at all, it literally does not matter, just so long as you do not lose the status.
Yeah, fair call. In my account on RuneScape, I don't think I've ever died to a dragon, and I've never been scared to, I guess, with the high HP, run across dragons with Protect from Magic or something on and just eat through it. But on a hardcore, I don't think I would risk that. But it's funny thinking about it like that. So how did you die, Bob? I know you told me, but it's been some time.
I remember it like it was yesterday. The TLDR is I died to a quest boss, and I died because I was too greedy. So, are you familiar with the vampire quest line?
The
Myrak or whatever, and then you go in and you, like, kill the vampire bosses in the stronghold and...
Oh, I don't think I've done that quest. That's the quest where the Theater of Blood is, right? Is that the one where you go through the agility course?
The rooftops and stuff like that, and you jump over them all, and yeah, it's that kind of crap.
Yep.
So you haven't done that?
No, I haven't done it, but I know of the quest, and I've seen YouTube vids of the quest as I was preparing to
do it. Yeah. So the quest boss for that, Rakan Drakan or whatever his name is, level 270-something, I think. And he has three phases on the boss fight, I think. And then the phase that I got too greedy on was the one where he shoots like lightning from the sky. So basically to avoid it, you just step out of the way every couple of seconds kind of thing. And I was walking under him and I ran out of food and he was on like 50 hit points or something garbage like that. And I decided to risk it and I died.
Oh no.
And It was an absolutely mortifying feeling, and I was like in a state of disbelief, like what the fuck just happened. But I'm glad that I died on my own terms and not to like a disconnect. If I died to a disconnect, I probably would have been like, what the fuck? So yeah, it was crazy, man. Like the weeks leading up to that, I would have worse and worse nightmares of waking up in the middle of the night thinking that I'd lost my hardcore status. It was actually crazy. So in a way, I'm kind of glad that it's over. The emotional investment in that was just too much. It was fun and it was really heavy, but Jesus Christ, I could not do that again.
Did you have that feeling after you died where you've got that stream of thoughts where what if I had done this? Why did I do that? And all these why questions start popping
Absolutely. Up? So like, it was probably like my fourth or fifth attempt at the boss fight as well, because I kept teleporting out because I didn't want to die. And yeah, there was something different about this particular attempt where I was like, oh no, I'm definitely going to get it this time. But alas, I'm no longer a hardcore on that account, but it was fun.
Oh, that's a gutting experience, man.
Oh, it was just thinking about all those agility levels and all that bullshit that I went through. It was really good and the whole thing was pretty memorable, but yeah, it was absolutely the ultimate, like, see everything you've worked towards disappear moment, you know? So yeah, now back on my main, that's like level 83 construction, 95 magic and 94 slayer or something, and away from maxing. So not much left.
I have a similar story. It's in the poker sense. So this is a little bit sad, but I was playing in the, so once a year at the Crown Casino in Melbourne, they host the Aussie Million Series. So that's earlier in the year, and it's once a year, and there's a bunch of tournaments and a whole lot of cash games going. So I'm generally a cash game player, in saying that if the tournaments are considered soft enough where I feel like I have a valid edge on the player pool, in these types of scenarios where there's a huge tournament with multiple different players, a lot of the field are recreational players, and even the regulars or the quote professionals, they're quite soft. So there are very, very good players who attend these huge tournaments, but majority of people, there are definitely sufficient enough recreational players where I feel like I do have a slight edge on the game. So in this instance, the main event is the entry fee for this tournament is around 10,000 Australian dollars. At the time, that's considered quite high compared to the bankroll that I have. And I was playing cash games. I was winning a bit of money. I was playing pretty good. So I felt confident, and I decided to enter this $10,000 tournament. First day comes around. I'm playing 8 hours or so with the breaks in between. Cool. I make it through to day two. And then I think within 2 hours of day two, so bear in mind, after the 8 hours, I go back to my hotel room, I sleep, I have to think about all the things, or, you know, recap on my strategy, go back out there, play, and then I get knocked out. So in poker, in a tournament, if there's something like 1,000 players who enter, they'll post the earnings. So maybe the top 100 get paid or something like that, or the top 150, depending on the format. So I had missed it by a long shot. So I ended up playing like 500, 600. But in my mind, as soon as I got knocked out, as I was walking back to the hotel room, I was just thinking, shit, that is literally months of me playing hundreds of hours of cash game to get that money back. And I've just blown it all in one shot, all because I was sitting there in the hotel room during the day one and day two break, thinking, oh, it's going to be so good to win it. It's going to be so nice if I win the top money. No. And that's the only thing that I was thinking. Yeah. Yeah, so I just felt devastated. And, you know, walking back to the hotel room, I was just thinking, what if I did that? Or what happened? What if I just folded that hand? Or what if I didn't push all in? What if I wasn't so aggressive there? So I think for the next few days, it really impacted my cash gameplay, where I was playing a lot more conservative, and I was like, oh, I don't want to take these aggressive routes. And then the next day I'd be way too aggressive trying to get back my money. And then I'll tone it down the next day. And it took a few days to stabilize out, but I definitely had that sinking feeling when I got knocked out, and then the realization of how much money that meant to me personally.
Oh yeah. I can't even imagine.
there's funny situations in poker. It's an interesting game where some of the even the best poker players in the world, they have ridiculous kind of tales where they one player, for example, ran up $100 in online play and ran it all the way up to a few million, and then he lost it all. And I'm sitting there like, jeez, imagine the emotional tilt that guy would have gone through.
And they lost $100, so.
Well, yes. Oh, yes, of course. Net result is -100.
At least, yeah. That's how you'd rationalize it after all of that, right? You'd be like, oh, I just lost $100.
Yeah. For me, I just rationalize it too. I didn't lose $10,000. In the long run, I'm still winning. The net result. Always think about the net result.
I don't remember which episode it was, but I was talking about an experience I had with some dodgy shit that happened in professional magic, where basically people are like, hey man, like a pre-negotiated drawing or determination of match outcome. I'm guessing that you don't really see that in poker at all.
Like, what do you mean by kind of predetermination? As in people lose by they fix matches?
Yeah, pretty much. So, like, if someone needs a particular result so that they can get a certain outcome, so normally it will be for someone getting a invitation to the Pro Tour, which doesn't happen anymore because it doesn't exist. So they need to win a certain number of games in order to qualify and get that invitation. So they will just straight up ask you at the start, hey, look, I'll give you half the winnings if you agree to draw.
Ah, well, no, luckily there is a process in poker. If you're in a tournament final table, for example, and it doesn't have to be large. So if you're in a 1,000-person tournament or even a 100-person tournament, you're top 9, and everyone there, kind of the prize pool has gotten so big or inflated that they feel they just want to divvy it up, then there is a process where they agree to split based on how many chips they have or based on some kind of agreement. So if there's kind of two people left, three people left, they'll divvy it up by proportionate prize pool remaining with the amount of chips they have in front of them or something like that. So we don't really have that kind of match fixing, so to speak.
Huh, okay. So you don't just have, like, people go out on a smoke and be like, hey, man, like, I really need to win this. I'll give you a certain percentage of winnings or whatever.
No, because I guess in Magic, it's different. In poker, it's all about money at the end of the day. The end result is money. The placing you get is money. Your chips are worth money. So there's no real incentive for losing on purpose. Like if I was playing a cash game with you and I said, hey, Rob, if you lose all your money to me, I'll split it 50-50. I'll return your money back to you. In that scenario, there's no real gain, so to speak. Right.
Yeah, fair enough.
There's no real value of kind of winning or beating a specific player in poker. I'm sure there is to some tiny degree, but it's not as much as Magic or that format where you must win to go to a tournament or something like that.
You could feed a whole shitload of chips onto someone, I guess, but then, yeah.
Funny you say that. Yes, there are cases, and that is considered cheating, where you deliberately lose. So in, let's say, really simple example, a 10-man tournament, you would have one person, or you'd have three of your friends enter and yourself into a 10-man tournament, and they would deliberately lose all their chips to you. That's really odd, because if all four of you were good players, then yeah, that's not the most optimal strategy, because all four of you paid the prize pool an equal share to enter the event. It's not a good strategy. It's a suboptimal strategy to do it, but there have been cases like that, and that is considered cheating. So you can't do that.
No.
Yeah, but it is suboptimal to do that. A tournament life is worth way more than the chip value, so kind of pooling all your chips into one person would be counterintuitive.
So we have the opposite of tilt as well, right? Which Most of the time, it has a very similar name. You could usually refer to it as a state of flow or getting so into the moment that essentially everything just really works well for you kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Pretty agnostic as to what it can happen to because you can pretty much achieve it in anything, but usually like programmers and stuff tend to enter into that kind of zen mode when they're knocking out a shitload of work and they can really get their rhythm down and they start producing a shitload of high quality content, TM. Is there anything similar to that in poker as well? Or?
Yeah, there's multiple different areas. For example, I guess this would be considered the positive version, but it does have a lot of negative side effects. So that story, which I told you with that one guy who went from $100 to $1 million, the way he did that was really simple. So he was a naturally gifted player. His screen handle is Isildur1, and he's famous on the internet for doing stuff like this. So he'll start off with $100 and play in a cash game. He'll quickly get $200 and then he'll enter the $200 games. And then he'll go from there and he'll play in the $500 games and then the $1,000 games. And it'll just keep scaling up. And it's that kind of momentum where I'm doing well, so I'm just going to go into the next bracket, and I'll completely ignore anything to do with proper bankroll management, proper money management, proper understanding of variance. I'm pretty sure he did have a really good understanding of variance, but I don't think it mattered to him. He was just very aggressive. So he kept doing that. That's how he got to that kind of $1 million mark, just because he was so good at the game that he was able to take $100, make $200, and then $400, and then $800, and $1,600, and so on and so on. And it was so crazy to watch. But then that comes at a cost, right? You keep doing that, and eventually you'll lose. It's kind of like that strategy in roulette. Do you know what that strategy is called? Where you lose, and then if you bet like $1, then you lose, and then you bet like $2 plus one, so $3. If you lose that, you bet like $6 plus one, which is $7, and you keep doing that until you win. And then once you win, you put down $1 again. There is, I forget the name of that strategy, but it seems foolproof from the sounds of it. But no, it's not. It's not.
All optimal gambling strategies require you to have an infinite supply of money.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And it seems to somehow scale with some kind of power of two, which people don't seem to grasp very well.
Oh, man. What about work? Do you get into flow much at work? Probably not these days, I imagine.
I try to implore or try to utilize as much of my learnings from mental game that I've learned from poker into work. And that basically means trying to remove as much emotional impairment from the decisions I make at work. But that also works vice versa as well. It's very tough for me to get into a mode where I'm consistently in a positive tilt mode, if you can call it that. I don't know how I could really be in a positive tilt mode. It's not like I sit there configuring core devices or configuring customer devices and I go, yes, three in a row. Perfect.
Jesus.
No.
Yeah, but at that point, it's like, why didn't I write a script to do this?
Exactly. Yeah, it's hard for me to get into that. But yes, I do have Zen modes where it's not really positive tilt, but I sit there after my coffee, I sit down and then I just get cracking. And then by the time I look up, it's 3 o'clock. I have not gone for lunch. I haven't done anything and I've just been zoned in and I've done all my tasks for the day. Boom.
Nice. Yeah, I've had a few moments. Well, pretty much every day ends up being like that, honestly. Get into work, make a coffee, sit down, bam, it's like 11 o'clock. And I'm like, oh, shit. But yeah, in terms of actual proper flow moments, no, I haven't had them in quite a long time. I don't think it's a little sad, but I think it was really good to have them when I was doing like a bunch of scripts or something, like the robots for Vodafone, or I don't think I've done anything kind of equivalent at my current job, but mostly it tends to be more around that, I guess, creative stuff that you can get that sort of thing going. So if you're like an engineer or like a manager, you're probably not going to be able to get into that state of mind quite so easily, I imagine.
Yeah. I think the parts of mental game that I utilize quite a lot of at work is I take the approach of, this may not necessarily be mental game, but it's something that I've learned indirectly from it. You don't sit there at work or life in general where you expect happiness to come to you. You must be able to find happiness from whichever small sources of things in life. And you must be actively looking for it in order to really achieve happiness. If you're sitting there thinking and asking yourself, you know, why am I so unhappy? Why am I kind of sad or depressed? Flip it around and try and actively search for happiness. And that's something that during really difficult times at work, I've explored quite extensively. So I might take a step back and I might go, okay, what happened today? What are the highlights for me today? And really narrow it down. And even day to day, I'll take moments out of my work day where I've had a really shitty day, for example, but I'll be making the coffee in the morning and then I'll sit down and I'll have a look outside. The weather's nice and I'll be sipping on my coffee and go, actually, this is a pretty happy moment, and I'll let this vibe I'll channel this vibe and I'll let it run with me throughout the day. So I need to actively do that instead of being passive about it. And that's something that I've kind of explored quite a lot on indirectly off of mental game. And I've utilized that in work to try and be as focused as I can, try and be as happy, as positive influence as I can. It's to actively try and find those positive sources instead of being passive and sitting back.
Absolutely. I fully agree with that, actually, the whole take an action side of things. I think it's a huge thing at work as well. For basically, it is so easy to be in, not a content creator, but like an influencer in the workplace. Like, I almost want to say like project, but it's not the right word, but to instill and to generate a vibe, for instance. It's something that's hugely important to me and something that I'm really conscious of, is to just do something which is probably pretty small and just like ask people I need to worry about or who are in my team, like ask them how they're doing or like how their day is, or just talk to them about some dumb shit that I really don't care about because it makes them feel happy. Or the other thing was to do something that you might not agree with, but, or give a shit about, but just really like make someone's day just so that they're happy.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm one of those people where you come into work on Monday and I will have those 5 minute kind of chats with people, you know, how was your weekend? And I'll talk and I'll try and be as best I can an active listener where I play back what they've kind of told me. So for example, if they say they went to, the in-laws over the weekend, then I'll be like, oh, that must suck. Or what was that like? What's the dynamic? I'll try and be, active. To be completely honest with you, that's not really me. I don't find interest in kind of sharing my weekend stories with people, but I appreciate the importance of that in a workplace and for building kind of that rapport and the effect it has on the human element of being an employee. So I try to do the best that I can, but it's not something innately that I do or I enjoy. If it was just up to me and if I was the only person in this world that I cared about, I'd just rock into work. And if someone asked me what I did in the weekend, I'd just say, sleep. And then I'll probably walk away. But that's kind of me. But I need to actively kind of do that to provide a positive kind of, or try to create a positive influence at work.
Same. Like, I do go out of my way. And then, like, if I ask someone how their weekend was and they say, pretty average or whatever, and then if they try to shut it down, and then I'm like, I tell them way too much about my weekend that was also very boring, to try to get them to open up, like, just that kind of bullshit small talk that just makes people feel a little bit happier inside and starts their day off on a slightly better note.
Yeah, and one thing that I've also kind of noticed is don't underestimate the importance of laughter within a team, the ability to genuinely create moments of happiness and generally laugh about things. You know, if you're able to make your colleagues laugh in a genuine way, that is really, really powerful, especially during stressful times at work, hard times. You know, people always stress it in customer-facing jobs. And, you know, if you're genuinely able to come out of that laughing, then you're doing a damn good job.
Yeah, if only there was a way to make that an employable skill somehow.
I've been, interestingly enough, as we're going and hiring people, it's something that I'm kind of looking out for. I realize that when you're hiring someone, there is a whole area of cultural fit, which is in some cases a lot more important than the simple ability of is this person able to do the tasks required in this job.
Now, I'm pretty sure that that is the whole point of at least one of the interviews, right? Like, in my experience, there's normally like one or two sort of interviews, maybe three, depending on what sort of job it is. But I would say that at least one or two of them is purely working out cultural fit.
Yep, it should be. Whether companies pay enough attention to that, I'm not sure. I think we're doing a much better job as a whole now than we were, let's say, 20, 30 years ago on my parents' time. But there's always areas or room for improvement, obviously.
So you don't have any vacation booked, do you?
No, I don't think I've taken any vacation since my time at my company. It's been like just under 2 years. Wait, has it been more than 2 years? No, it's been like a year and a half. I started last year in March, so I guess 1 year and 5 months. I haven't taken much vacation. I think I took like 1 or 2 days off, mandatory during like the Christmas period, but that's about it.
Yeah, I'm thinking I'm kind of overdue for some travel when the borders open up. I'm not game enough to go back to Europe quite yet, but maybe somewhere in Asia or even Australia at this point, I would probably consider as okay. Just to relieve some of that tension, you know, stop proactively prevent some of that tilt.
So which areas in Asia were you thinking of to relieve said tension, Rob?
Oh my, yes, I think that might be enough for today. Yeah, like, honestly, I don't know, like, seeing the business parts of India really opened my eyes to some experiences, you know. My 2 weeks in Ahmedabad really broadened my world views. Visiting some third world countries in Southeast Asia would probably be the next step in that. Maybe some check out the Philippines or something, or get some work done in Thailand or.
It's interesting. I've been fortunate enough when I was little to have parents which thought really highly of global travel and the importance of appreciating different cultures. I didn't fully appreciate it, and I probably still won't until I'm much older. But for now, what I've appreciated is the way that I kind of approach it from a kind of game theory point of view or kind of dissecting it is if you look at different types of cultures and different ways that people, you know, live and work, and you obviously look at Asia, for example, a lot of Asian countries have huge, densely packed populations living in really small areas, and that drives a lot of kind of cultural aspects, such as people are way more competitive, the job market is way more fierce, and there are just so many different things which are completely different. But if you expose yourself to a lot of that, and you observe a lot of different people coming from different backgrounds, from the game theory point of view, you realize that you've been living in this tiny segmented bubble, and there are many different games and many different game trees and paths, and there are various different optimal strategies that you just didn't have your eyes open to. So you can take little bits from different cultures to try and try and really optimize your approach to life and your approach to work. And that's something that I've kind of explored as well. I try to take the positives. I respect that there's a lot that I respect in kind of Japanese culture and Korean culture, you know, going from my Korean heritage, that I try and take on board to my life. And I consider myself to be pretty Kiwi because I've lived here for basically all my life. But being exposed to various different kind of cultures, I try and learn, or at least try to take the best of all those worlds and try to incorporate that into my life. But I think travel definitely unlocks, or is a starting point on in unlocking that kind of eye-opening journey.
So as the Japanese, you like 2-hour train commutes and staying in the office for 10 hours a day? Or
there's kind of the Japanese, from what I've gathered, what I've seen in Japanese culture, there is this whole thought process about what identity truly means and what doing things for the greater good is. For example, students in Japan, starting from when they're little at school, they will take turns cleaning and they don't think of it as a chore just because it doesn't necessarily give them any benefit. They understand the importance of the benefit as a whole to a community or to a school or to the country, to a greater good that is so instilled in them from when they were little. And that shapes how they act. And that's why they are, you know, really courteous. They're really, you know, you go on the subway and no one is talking. They don't make a sound. They may be a bit overly too in tune to that.
Sensitive.
Yeah. But in that regard, I respect that quite a lot, the idea of doing things or appreciating for the greater good and not just being selfish in your actions and always thinking about the environment, thinking about your company, thinking about others in general, thinking about your company, your friends, everything like that. There's something that you can really learn and appreciate from being exposed to that culture.
I remember speaking to someone who I think taught English sort of thing. I think they went over to teach it, but I think it was in Korea. I can't remember which. But anyway, in wherever, I can't remember if it's Japan or Korea, there's this pyramid sort of thing about values. And in Western culture, it's basically like myself is at the top of the pyramid. But in Asian culture or in whatever culture, like I think it was Japan, it was like flipped up. So at the top you had like community instead of self, so that your values were, instead of putting yourself first, you would put your community first, you put your country first kind of thing. Whereas in Western civilization, it's me first, then community, then country or whatever. And so the ways that we build the values and teach people to be people is just an entirely different perspective. And yeah, there is a lot of stuff that I do like about the Japanese culture, but there's so much negative stuff there as well. From everyone's like a workaholic, everyone's like not closed up, but like reserved. They have some very weird opinions on very particular things, like they're not very receptive to outsiders participating in their community based environments. It's very difficult for people who aren't from the country to get properties to live in and stuff like that. But yeah, overall, yeah. I think, yeah, there's a lot of value in looking at their positive impact as well.
There will always be negatives, and there will always be positives. And I would challenge if there was a typical example of a person in Japan who carries a lot of those negatives. You'll notice if they do go for like a 1 or 2 year OE, and they go to a Western country and they come back, you'll notice that they absorb a lot of the what they think are changes or positives from Western culture, and they take that back to Japan. And I've seen this in kind of exchange students where they change over the course of a year or 2 years, and you'll see them kind of stabilizing out. But yeah, there are positives and negatives, but just going back to the original point of when you expose yourself to various different cultures and realize that the world is huge and you're just living in a tiny little bubble, then you can really adapt and absorb and learn quite a lot from different cultures, good or bad. Could be both.
It's funny you mentioned that. I literally just watched Endgame like 2 nights ago. Speaking of good and bad being perfectly balanced, you know.
Yes, you have the yin and you have the yang. There will always be...
Such an average movie. Such an average movie, let me tell you.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Oh, mate. Highly recommend to watch, but such an average movie.
I've been meaning to watch the Avatar series, the Last Airbender.
Yes.
And I finally watched all of it after spending years just watching clips on it. So I'm pretty sure I had seen it with the copious amount of clips that I've seen on YouTube, but you know, I decided to watch it end to end, and that was a really good series.
Yeah, there's lots of good stuff on it. I haven't watched heaps of it myself.
Oh, you haven't? There's just to take a little excerpt, which goes really nicely with what we've talked about in Tilt. In the second series, The Legend of Korra, there is a supposed bad guy who turns into an airbender, and he just becomes so philosophical. To master the art of airbending, you must detach yourself from all earthly kind of possessions and break free from the chain that hold you, bound you to earth. And that's like, oh shit, that's mental game. You need to break free from all of those negative thoughts that connect you to money and poker, or connect you to the actual end result, the plus and minuses at the end of the day. Break free and focus on the true strategy.
Focus on the now.
Yes, you must live in the now. Break free from the past. Become enlightened.
I think they're redoing it or making it into a... No, they already made it into a movie.
No, they didn't. I'm just going to ignore that one. That doesn't exist. I don't know what you're talking about. That's not canon. We'll just ignore that there is a live-action movie.
Not canon. Mm.
It's like saying Dragon Ball has a live-action movie. No, it does not. Let's not go there.
I haven't seen that one either.
Yeah.
Is it bad?
It doesn't exist. Just ignore it.
That's terrible. All right, gotcha. So I think it's been an hour now. We talked a lot about getting emotional in games today and how emotions and people's emotional experiences in the workplace are valuable and should be cherished, and we should go out of our way to do something out of character that is not innately part of us to make sure that other people are happy.
You sound like you're reading that off a script. But yes.
Pause.
Yes, I agree.
Pause for applause.
Oh.
Yeah, and we also talked about a little bit about the state of flow or anti-tilt, I guess, but not so much on that. So yeah, some great content there, and it's always great to hear your life experience and your worldviews and get to know a little bit more about how you see the world.
I wonder if we'd be a lot more productive the next time if we just crack open a few beers and then just let it just stream out.
You know what? That sounds like a good idea. We'll do that next time, eh?
Yep, it'll be on par with the lockdown drinking.
Oh, yes. Perfect.
Yep. Where even non-alcoholics start drinking.
I've not had a beer for 30 years. All right, I am going to stop the recording now. Thank you very much, Will. As always, it's been a pleasure.
Ooh, thanks for having me.
Any final thoughts to tie it up?
No, happy lockdown. And I expect this will probably be a few more weeks of lockdown at the minimum. Guess we can use this opportunity to reflect on ourselves and improve our mental game.
Beautiful. Yeah,
A game all day every day.
Bring your A game.
All right, thanks, Rob.
All right, until next time.